dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week we're going to go beyond the idea of a few bad apples to examine the relationship between torture, the state, and some of the professionals who torture in the name of the state, both recently in terms of the United States, as well as perspectives of other times and places. We're going to begin with a talk by sociologist Marnia Lasreg of Hunter College, whose recent book, Torture and the Twilight of Empire, From Algiers to Baghdad, looks at the intimate relationship between torture and colonial domination through a close examination of the French army's coercive tactics during the Algerian War from 1954 to 1962. By tracing the psychological, cultural, and political meanings of torture at the end of the French Empire, she also sheds new light on the United States and its recourse to torture in Iraq and Afghanistan. She spoke in New York City on May 10, 2008.
I would like to share some of my thoughts about first how I came to do this kind of work. I'm a sociologist by training. I never dealt with torture before. It all happened in the summer of 2001. I was in Algiers and I passed by a bookstore window. And I looked in and I saw these two books that really, leapt at me. One was written by General Paul Osares, who was General Massu's sidekick. And for those of you who have watched or seen the film, The Battle of Algiers, Massu is portrayed in it. He was the chief paratrooper who had, launched what has been called the Battle of Algiers. So Paul Osares was his sidekick, and he wrote this book called Special Services in French, Service Spéciaux, which was immediately translated into English as The Battle of the Casbah. And next to that book, there was one written by an Algerian woman who had kept silent for over 40 years. She had joined the Front of National Liberation in her youth and was captured by paratroopers outside of Algiers in 1957 and was subjected to repeated rape and torture for nearly 11 weeks. So I was, intrigued, by these two completely different books, one written by a torturer who specifically described, in much detail how he tortured hundreds of Algerians and how he buried some of them according to the Muslim rite, with their heads turned towards Mecca, the east. This is how you bury a Muslim. So it was really absolutely incredible to read, this account. And after my trip to Algiers and went to France, because this is when you have been formally colonized, you go from your capital to the capital of the colonizer. So I was in Paris, and this is where I buy my books. And there, I also noticed a whole series of books, some, you know, written from a scholarly perspective. There's a whole new young generation of French historians who are looking into the issue of torture. And there were also confessions to torture, just like, you know, Paulo Sarès's, and diaries, you know, war diaries. So there was a whole, this critical mass, you know, of documentation on torture. And there were also magazines, very expensive magazines, glossy magazines, showing pictures of people in stress positions. So I was very intrigued, you know, how the Algerian war and torture that was so crucial to it, you know, had become packaged. And so when I came back, you know, to the U.S., I wanted to look, you know, into this issue of torture. So I was driven really by three major questions. The first question was, is it true, as I was reading, that torture is about gathering intelligence? The second question I had was, why is it that countries, states that prohibit torture are so eager to resort to it, you know, sometimes blithely? And the third question I asked myself was, you know, is torture truly about torture? So I find myself, you know, having to do archival research, you know, in the military archives, you know, outside of Paris in Vincennes. And I also did archival research, you know, in Algeria. And I read all of those confessions and diaries written by former French soldiers, as well as some, not that many, written also by, you know, the Algerian victims, you know, of torture. So I found something that I didn't know before. I had received this, you know, wonderful fellowship at the Institute for Advanced Study, you know, in Princeton. And there I met a historian, a military historian, who had written about what happened in Algeria, but had not gotten into the detail, you know, of torture. And in talking to him and reading, you know, his books, I realized that the systematic use of torture during the Algerian War was part and parcel of a theory which the French generals called guerre révolutionnaire, revolutionary war theory, on which they based a military doctrine which gave the army a strategy for fighting, you know, a subversive war. And this revolutionary war theory defined wars of national liberation, wars of decolonization, as well as civil wars, as subversive wars, revolutionary in their goals. And to fight them, they developed this three-pronged strategy. One was to use regular military operations, like any, you know, regular army does. The other one was to model the army also after the organization of the guerrillas in order to achieve mobility and stealth. And the third part of the strategy was to wage an all-out psychological warfare. And this is where brainwashing also became important. And all of these component parts of the strategy included torture. Even, for example, a unit created by the army called Section Administrative Spécialisée, in short, you know, SAS, you know, administrative special, you know, administrative sections, which was supposed to win the hearts and minds of the people. This is very interesting. By providing medical services, and this is something that we have been hearing about also in Iraq and Afghanistan lately, you know, in the New York Times. So they would provide medical services, and they created a special social workers corps to go into people's homes and try to sell the war to the French view of the war to housewives. Even these SAS also had a torture chamber. And they also used, you know, the doctors and the social workers essentially as, you know, security agents, you know, to gather intelligence and information on the local population. So I then realized that even though torture had been used during the colonial era, Algeria had been colonized, invaded in 1830, and France did not leave until 1962. And the war started in 1954. But prior to 1954, the French police would use brutal treatment, you know, against Algerian prisoners. On occasion, they would also use, you know, torture. And I might add, they also used it against, you know, French people who belonged to the Communist Party. And when the Communist Party had been outlawed, then the French, you know, the French communists, if they were arrested, they would be tortured too. So even though torture existed, it was not systematic. And this is very, very important. And so I linked the systematic use of torture that began in 1954 and ended in 1962 to the anxiety and the identity crisis that the French military was experiencing at the realization that the French Empire was collapsing. We have to understand that in 1954, France, you know, May 1954, France had already had been defeated at Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam. The officers who had been fighting the Viet Minh were sent to Algeria to fight, you know, the Front of National Liberation. And it is among those officers who had been serving in Vietnam that this guerre révolutionnaire theory, theory of revolutionary war, and the doctrine based on it had been elaborated. And let's also remember that France had lost Madagascar in the Indian Ocean. Morocco and Tunisia were negotiating their independence. So Algeria was appeared, you know, to the French officers as the last bastion of the empire, which they wanted to keep by all means necessary. And so this doctrine that they elaborated is really, you know, incredibly powerful. It's a very important logical, logically related view of how the French military perceived their empire. They had these military reviews, journals, in which you know, some of the ideologues, you know, wrote under sometimes pseudonyms, and they would, you know, talk about, you know, how great the French mission was, not simply just the mission civilisatrice, civilizing mission, but they felt that they had been creating men, l'homme. They were creating men wherever they went. So they were not, they were actually giving birth to new human beings. And that project, you know, was, you know, being thwarted now by the Vietnamese and the Algerians, you know, were going to finish the job that the Vietnamese had started. And between parentheses, en passant, I have to tell you that the French officers, the soldiers, actually, very often refer to the Algerian combatants as the Viets. So there's a psychological function, I think, that this label fulfilled for the French officers, because the memory of the defeat at Dien Bien Phu was very recent, and calling the Algerian FLN the Viets somehow made them, you know, think that, you know, they were still in Vietnam, but this time they were going to win. So it was very, psychologically, it was very, very important. I realized later on that, you know, this revolutionary war theory and the doctrine based on it had been taught to the CIA and in many military schools here in the United States by the very people who had formulated it and or had implemented it. General Osares, came to the U.S. and between 61 and 63, he actually taught the CIA and, a number, Fort Benning, for example, and Fort Bragg. He taught about, how the Algerian war was fought, and he also explained the crucial role that torture played in the doctrine. So that was very, very interesting to me. And also, Operation Phoenix, for example, in 1968 in Vietnam, had been one of the most, fantastic applications of the French theory and doctrine. So there's a whole historical background here that links the manner in which the French had fought the war in Algeria and the manner in which the U.S. today is fighting the war in both Iraq and Afghanistan. So if one looks at this military doctrine and the theory on which it's based as an ideological structure, then torture appears differently. Today here in the U.S., we hear one day there's an article in the New York Times, another there's an editorial, in the Washington Post. Then we have had all the debates in 2006 and more recently about, what constitutes torture and whether one method of torture, such as waterboarding, should not, in fact, be prohibited. So this is all fragmented, out of context. And because people don't know that there's a whole historical and ideological background to this, it appears, the explanations that were given appear quite plausible. So when we replace torture in this historical background, then we can demystify a number of things. The first thing that we can demystify is that torture is not about intelligence, even though some intelligence can be gathered through torture. And those of you who have seen the Battle of Algiers, may have gotten that message, although that film, overstates the case of torture as a very quote-unquote useful method, for dismantling the organization of the FLN. Torture is about force, torture is about domination, and torture is about identity. Torture is a holistic situation in which individuals, the torturer and the tortured, face each other as embodiments of different national histories, political orientations, and, of course, culture, different cultures and different worldviews. I always found it very interesting how General Paul Osares, on his way to torturing an Algerian whom he ended up actually killing, was thinking about the Battle of Valmy that took place in 1793. This was 4 years after the French Revolution of 1789, and this was a time when the Prussian forces had invaded Republican revolutionary France. This is very interesting. Now, if you look at the book that Tony Lagoranis, a former interrogator at Abu Ghraib, you find that he, between sessions, interrogation sessions, torture sessions, he was reading The Fall of Napoleon, the defeat of Napoleon after Moscow and how he retreated. Napoleon retreated from Moscow, and he was thinking, is also the U.S. going to retreat from Baghdad? So, this political identity, this imagery is very, very fascinating. A torture is also not just one method that's inflicted on a person until, he or she talks. In fact, torture is always inflicted in combination. And this is very, very important. Lagoranis also makes this point. When he was at Abu Ghraib, he said he always used torture in combination. So when we have all of this discussion about whether waterboarding should be prohibited or not, we're actually shifting the debate from prohibiting torture once for all to saying that, well, some methods are less painful than others, and therefore we should allow them to stand. And that's completely at odds with what goes on within the torture chamber. So one has to understand also that torture, as I said earlier, it's a holistic phenomenon. It has a beginning and it has a development and it has an end. At first, a person is pummeled, slapped, kicked, and then tortured specifically with specific combination of methods. In between, there would be more pummeling and kicking and insulting and inflicting slurs, you know, on the person, and then you torture, and then you continue to do all of those things. Then, you know, you bring back the person for more torture the following day, and it goes on and on and on. So to just look at torture as a series of discrete methods really misses the point entirely. I also found that the core of torture is sexual. Sex is a very, very important component of torture, so that, you know, when people say that, you know, oh, what happened at Abu Ghraib is really just distasteful, but it's really not torture. In fact, that is essential to breaking the resistance of the individual. And why? Because, you know, our identity is based in our sexuality. Sexual humiliation is part of the psychological torture that's necessary for bringing the individual to lose completely any sense of control. I actually analyze what goes on during some of these sexual tortures. And I found that the Nazis had done similar things. You know, there's a German, Klaus Thebolite, who wrote 2 volumes documenting, you know, the methods, sexual methods used, among others, by the Nazis. They would tie a prisoner to a post, and of course he's naked, because the first act of torture is to make the victim strip. And so they had the naked prisoners, and they whipped them on their buttocks, and they would urge them to scream and scream and scream. And they, of course, were having, you know, these vicarious sexual feelings while they were whipping the naked prisoners through the post. The French would use electricity. You put electrodes to the genitals of the detainee, and of course you send the current that courses through the body of the detainee. Sometimes he's flung up, and the language used by the torturers is also highly sexualized. So the upshot of this sexual torture is, in fact, to desexualize the detainee. He's desexed while made forcefully to simulate sexual acts such as the orgasm, and in the Iraqi context, of course, you know, masturbation and so forth and so on. Torture requires defining the people being tortured as subhuman. The French had this expression, sous-homme. It's more telling, you know, sous-homme. And in Iraq, what we have is the American prisoners being fed the ideology of the inferiority of the Iraqis, which they got out of this book by Rafael Patai, you know, The Arab Mind. And the Iraqis, as Arabs and Muslims, are seen as natural liars. Not only that, but the structure of their thinking is different from ours. We think, apparently, in a linear fashion, whereas they think by association. And once the state condones and orders in one way or another torture, torture becomes systematized. And the systematization of torture also requires its professionalization. And the French military had come up with this torture called humane torture, which was taught in special counter-guerrilla warfare schools. And I'd like to read to you what humane torture is. Okay, this is a young recruit, a young French soldier who went to the center where he was taught counter-guerrilla techniques, including humane torture. So he's talking. So torture must be, number one, clean, not take place in presence of young soldiers, not take place in the presence of sadists, not be inflicted by an officer or a person of rank, and must especially be humane, quote-unquote. That is to say, it must end as soon as the guy has talked, and mostly that it does not leave any trace. Considering which, in conclusion, you had the right to use water and electricity. This I have noted down as he, the instructing captain, spoke. And of course, this came out to the press, And the French government denied that it ever happened. But just to see the putting these two words that actually contradict each other, putting them together, humane torture, is very interesting. And this brings me to a very important point, which is the language in which we speak about torture. It is used as a very, very powerful tool for creating this distance between us and the people who are being tortured, and also making us somehow feel that torture is really not such a big deal. In the American press, we talk about enhanced interrogation, harsh interrogation, severe interrogation. In the French language, there were similar terms. Interrogatoire poussé, you know, very in-depth. And the one I prefer, because I think it's very telling, is interrogatoire sous contrainte. Literally, the interrogation is taking place under constraint. And of course, it creates this very interesting linguistic warp where you think that it is the person who is torturing, the torturer who is compelled, constrained, who is forced, who is coerced to torture. So you shift, in a way, the responsibility from one to the other. And I found something very interesting also. Some of the officers who were hardliners, who were ordering torture, they would also talk about torture in a very, very intriguing way. And I'd like to share with you what Colonel Argout, who was very well known for his very extreme methods, said about torture, how he defined it. Torture is an act of violence, just like the bullet shot from a gun, the cannon shell, the flamethrower, the bomb, napalm, or gas. Where does torture really start? With a blow with a fist, the threat of reprisal, or electricity? Torture is different from other methods in that it is not anonymous. The shell, the bomb, gas are often blind. Torture brings the torturer and his victim face to face. The torture, at least, has the merit of operating in the open. It is true that with torture, the victim is disarmed, but so are the inhabitants of a city being bombed, aren't they? So the people who order torture also get themselves tangled up in this language of euphemisms and dismissal of the very cruel and unusual core, you know, in terms of pain, of torture. I found that torture fulfilled a number of functions, and I'd like to just go over them here just for a few seconds. Torture is really very, very powerful means, tool of terror, and it takes place at the same time as reprisals, summary executions, the exposures of the bodies of the people accused of terrorism. Torture is also a significant tool for socializing the detainees into the view of the war, upheld, of course, by the occupying power. In the Algerian case, the combatants would be tortured, and then they would be subjected to brainwashing, and then they would be enrolled in an auxiliary corps called the Harka. The singular is Harki, and then they would be asked to torture other Algerians. And they were very, very much feared because they had to prove that they learned the lessons well and that, you know, they were not afraid of torturing the people that they might have been working with before. And torture related to this was used as a tool of social engineering. General Salon, who was very well known in the history of the Algerian War because he was one of the people who rebelled against the French government, he was one of the putschists, he had issued a very secret circular calling for the kidnapping of selected Algerians, placing them in secret camps and brainwashing them, and very often with preliminary use of torture, and creating a new race, species, if you will, of colonial subjects. And it goes back to my initial point that the French officers who formulated this military doctrine of anti-subversive war, they looked back at the history of the French Empire and they felt that they had been creating men. So in the Salon really wanted to create a new colonial subject. It sounds strange to us today, but this was taken very, very seriously. I just wanted to say a couple of words about how this scheme of actually creating a new subject could even have been taken seriously. Well, the French officers were using two different sets of theories. One was about crowd behavior, what happens to the individual psyche when a person is in a crowd. And they used the work of a very well-known, at the time, French sociologist who was a conservative man who had written against the French Revolution and felt it was just mob behavior that moved the revolution forward. So he studied, you know, what happens to the psyche of the individual when, you know, you put people in a situation of a crowd. And the other theorist whose work they used was a former assistant to Pavlov, who had done work on reflex conditioning. And Pavlov wanted to use the methods which the fascists used to create a following and modulating pain and brainwashing and create an individual who only searches for peace and happiness. So they developed a method for behavior modification. So the French officers put these two theories together and they realized that it made them think that, in fact, if they could only formulate the right kinds of techniques, they could win. And they could win even at the cost of engaging in some very bizarre scheme of brainwashing. And torture played a role in it because pain was found to be one of the methods in which to bring what Shackleton, this assistant of Pavlov, called inhibitions. Pain can bring the inhibitions level down, and that means resistance goes down. So I just wanted to share with you how, when we justify torture, and especially when intellectuals justify torture, they really do not provide, as far as I'm concerned, a very compelling intellectual foundation on which to make torture acceptable. They use the old formula, what the German philosopher Hegel called the means-ends formula. They justify torture in terms of the ends that it serves. That's a tired justification, of the structure of the justification. And what I found truly remarkable is that they base their justifications of torture on works of fiction. Michael Walzer uses Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist philosopher's play, Les Mains Sales, Dirty Hands. He also uses one of Camus' plays. Jean Bethke Elstein, a feminist who also a moral philosopher who supports torture, especially torture light. She bases her argument on her having watched the film Marathon Man, in which Dustin Hoffman remembers being tortured by one of the characters. Was it Laurence Olivier? I think it was. Yeah. And of course, I find that the structure of justification is wanting. It's not compelling enough. There's another aspect to justifications which I find very interesting, and that is religion. Religion continues to be a very powerful argument that is brought up when justifying torture. It's very clear if you look at the Algerian War, and it has become clearer in the U.S. If you remember, the media had told us that there were evangelists embedded with the troops when we invaded Iraq. I want to share with you what one priest, Father Louis de la Rue, had said in his justification of torture. In 1957, this chaplain who was working in the eastern mountains of Algeria with paratroopers issued this defense of torture, which helped General Massu tremendously because he was lending torture his authority as a priest. And he wrote an essay called Between Two Evils, Entre Deux Mots, in which he argued that the torture is no different from the death penalty. We execute people all the time, so what's the big deal? Why can't we torture them? Second, he echoed one of the tenets of brainwashing and torture, and that is that the Algerian people's nature called for force, for the use of force, and therefore torturing them is doing them a favor. And not only that, but the torture of Muslims, Algerians qua Muslims, has a redemptive value. We're actually bringing them to the level of civilizational values that we, the French people, have. The ticking bomb scenario, which is often invoked, really, I have to tell you, there hasn't been one single concrete case that can be proven that it really was a case when torture truly saved lives. The cases are very, you know, it's not clear whether they actually took place because either the countries or the people who mention how torture worked in those cases were not telling the total story. So I'd like to read to you my conclusion here. I feel that torture cannot be authorized under any circumstance. And here I'd like to tell you that the United Nations Convention Against Torture has been amended in November 2007, a new document called General Comment Number 2 was issued that closes all of the loopholes that John Yoo and Alberto Gonzalez felt existed and in which they plunged headlong. So the general comment number 2 reiterates the fact that not only torture, but ill treatment are non-derogable. You cannot engage in them. Number 2, it's the state's responsibility to make sure that torture is not and ill treatment are not practiced in any one of the territories in which they occupy or have jurisdiction over. So this was a way of saying that Guantanamo cannot be an island of torture, or that you cannot say that you can torture on bases in Iraq, and you cannot also send people to third countries when you know that they're going to be tortured, and they cannot be tortured in your name in any other country. So it closes all of those loopholes. So the propensity to retreat into torture as the most tried method of getting information reveals the archaic nature at the core of the democratic state. Unless this core is identified and extirpated, torture will recur again and again under the sponsorship of the state. No one is safe from it, not even its apologists. Do you have any questions? I'll be happy to answer them. Yes.
If you compare the torture in the last 50 years to what was done in the Middle Ages, was there any fundamental difference or same psychology and pathology?
Well, yes, that's a good question. There are differences. In the Middle Ages, up until about the mid 12th century to the 13th century, what existed were the ordeals. And, you know, God was involved in the ordeals. Remember, you dunked the hand of the person whose guilt or innocence you could not ascertain in a big cauldron with a hot oil, and then you waited. You know, if the person died or had the problem with his or her hand, then that meant that that person was really guilty. There are many other techniques, trying to drown people and so forth, putting hot irons, you know, on their chest or dismantling their bodies, the ordeals. But there was no real juridical notion of proof. It's God that was supposed to give the proof of the guilt or innocence of the individual. The monks or the priests in the second half of the 12th century discovered the Roman law of torture. And that, you know, came with a juridical notion of proof. You know, how do you determine whether a person is guilty or not? And so you had to have a confession, or you had to have witnesses, you know, one or two witnesses. And if you didn't have a confession, then you had to rely on witnesses, and which meant also relying sometimes also on circumstantial evidence. And this complicated, you know, it was meant to avoid the abuses of the ordeals. But because as time passed and the Roman law of torture was being refurbished, but essentially it was kept, then the judges came under pressure to make sure that they were getting evidence, they were getting confessions. And so the rationale behind this law of proof also worked against the protection of the tortured person from torture, which has led me to conclude that when torture becomes judicial, and this is something that Dershowitz would like to see happen. Dershowitz is a lawyer, for those of you who may not be familiar with him. He's a lawyer at Harvard University who has been advocating the issuance of torture warrants. He argues that we all know that torture exists, that it is being practiced, and we're just trying to look away from it. So why not protect people by actually making torture judicial, asking in some special circumstances if the police has sufficient evidence that the person might have information that is necessary. So the police would ask the judge for a torture warrant, and then you torture the person. And when that happens, and this is what happened essentially at the end of the Roman period, especially during the Roman Empire, and also at the end of the Middle Ages, the more you legislate torture, the more you ensure that it becomes routinized. Because there's more pressure now on judges to collect that information. And witnesses also, for example, they were warned, if you give false testimony, you will be tortured. So then the judges would just start torturing, and torture then just snowballs. And this is why torture really cannot be legislated. It cannot become judicial. It has to be prohibited once and for all. And I think the legislators who prohibited torture, they knew, I mean, they had based this on the extensive knowledge that they had of the use of torture, especially under the Roman Empire and in the second half of the Middle Ages. And they knew that you can never be sure that a tortured person is going to give you the information that you need, because it's such extreme pain that people will just say anything. I must say that the British were immune to this. For a very brief period of time, they had the equivalent of this judicial torture, the equivalent, not quite the same. To be tortured, the Privy Council had to issue a warrant, and then the person would be brought in to usually the Tower of London, and there would be a lawyer present to ask the questions and record the answers. There would be some medical, you know, person there, and there would be, of course, the torture. And they would also specify what kind of method would be used. But that didn't last very long. And actually, you'd be interested to note that a very, very famous man was among these lawyers in the Tower of London asking the questions, and that was Francis Bacon, when he was a very obscure lawyer. So there were a few instances where he had done that. But that's a very important question. So there is a difference. But today, of course, big difference today is that we have laws on the books that prohibit torture, but it's carried out anyway. And if you look at the U.S. intelligence operating manual, it really lists all of the methods that are prohibited. But we know that they're being used both in Guantanamo Bay and in Iraq. And of course, we're not talking about Afghanistan also. I mean, the torturers were in Afghanistan found their way also in Abu Ghraib. Yes.
Did the French government ever acknowledge, officially acknowledge its use of torture in Algeria?
Well, no, not after the war or during the war. Guy Mollet, the prime minister, who knew of torture, first denied it and then made a statement once in which he said, this is not a standard method. It doesn't happen all the time. It's just some misguided few bad apples, but we know it's against the law and so forth and so on. And even today, I mean, French historians have been writing about torture, but the government's not owning up to it. Not only that, but a few years ago, the French government actually issued a law, which then was dropped, enjoining schools to teach positively about colonialism, especially in North Africa. And that, of course, includes, you know, Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. And, of course, the French historians were very angry because this was essentially telling French schools that there was an official version of colonial history. And so French teachers and historians were opposed to it, and also the former colonies were opposed to it. And Algeria at the time was going to be signing a friendship treaty with France, and they decided to back out of it until this whole row died down. But that law was amended, so that part of the law was actually dropped. So, no, I mean, there is still a huge problem between France and her former colonies, but especially Algeria, because that's where torture was really used in a very systematic manner. It was used also in Vietnam, but we know more about how it was used in Algeria because it was part and parcel of this military doctrine which featured, you know, torture as one of its major components.
Are you making any statement about the military in general, or are you just saying the assumption that the military tortures? Is there any validity to having a military as part of life in any country?
No, I wasn't saying that. I'm sorry if you got this, maybe I was not too clear. No, I said at the end of an empire, torture appears as a very important method for keeping the power of the imperial nation in place. And the message that I'd like to convey is that torture was part and parcel of a military ideological structure. So it was not simply something incidental that happened on occasion because the French military grabbed someone whom they knew had some vital information. It was not that at all. It was used as the method of interrogation. And this was part and parcel of a military doctrine and an ideology. One of the designers of this doctrine, the Trinquier, called torture the antidote to terrorism, and he called it a war weapon. So, because what's happening today in the U.S. is that we're not quite sure of what's going on. It is the same thing is happening. Torture is part and parcel of what goes on in Iraq, in Guantanamo Bay, in Afghanistan. Actually, there is a historian at the University of Wisconsin, Alfred McCoy, you know, wrote a book called The Question of Torture, and it's a very serious book because it took him many years to show what's going on, the kinds of tortures that are being implemented in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere are really a continuation of the experiments with torture which the CIA had engaged in between 1952 and 1962. And by the way, in secret, the CIA was spending $1 billion a year between 1952 and 1962. And part of the research is, if you saw this film called Standard Operating Procedure, you would, you know, realize what I'm talking about. So part of the research was about looking at the degree to which sensory deprivation can expedite the process of lowering the resistance of the detainee being tortured. And then so they combined these number of methods, total deprivation of sight, sound, smell, like being in a completely sterile environment. They did that, and they would put a headphones with a looped message saying, my mother hates me, So it's really brainwashing and the manipulation of, you know, sensory senses. And then, of course, they would start humiliating the individual. So it's the combination of sensory deprivation, humiliation, and forms of brainwashing. And if you look at statements made by people who survived Guantanamo, and you have all of that, and if you read, you know, Tony Lagoranis' book, the title is Fear Up Harsh, and this title, Fear Up Harsh, is also the name of a method, a torture method, how you instill very high levels of fear in the individual by manipulating the knowledge that you have of that person, knowledge about the family, knowledge about the life of the individual, and what have you. And there is something else, by association of ideas. You know, I watched this film at the Lincoln Theater called A Standard Operating Procedure, and I learned that, you know, at Abu Ghraib, you have a number of children who had been kidnapped by the U.S. Army, and they were the children of former members of the Ba'ath Party or people whom they felt had information to give and they were not giving it. And you hear the people who had been, you know, involved in the Abu Ghraib scandal talk about these children in a somewhat sad way, saying, yeah, we have these children. And you see them, you know, one of them was raped by one of the prisoners, and the other was shown making this sound, you know, constant sound all night long with his sandals, and he was spending the night killing ants in the cell. And of course, you know you can clean the cells, and you know, but this is done under the behest, you know, under the surveillance of the army. This is going back to your question about the army.
For definition of torture, it seems to me that the medical profession is very invested and involved in the process. How do you think about this?
That is a very important question. Yes, the medical profession, not only medical doctors, but also psychologists and psychiatrists. Yes, that is a very, very important issue. And the research that has been done on sensory deprivation, just a background, was carried out by psychiatrists in a hospital in Canada and by psychiatrists and psychologists here in the United States. And right now, there are psychologists, you know, trained psychologists at Harvard University who support torture and would like to create a center of the science of intelligence gathering. That said, you had doctors, medical doctors, who were injecting Algerians with pentothal, which is a truth serum, and they would be on hand, you know, of course, to see to it that the treatment is done. You also had doctors who come in during a torture session when the torture session goes bad and the detainee has been really very badly damaged. The doctor comes in and tries to revive the detainee so he could be tortured some more. This is a very important question because the Hippocratic Oath is that you do not do harm to your patients. And here, the medical profession becomes an adjunct of the wars, whether wars of decolonization or wars of occupation. This is a very, very important ethical issue. And you probably know that the Psychological Association in the U.S. has been in trouble for this, and there are a number of people organizing against the complicity, an active complicity, of the psychological, you know, profession in torture. I think it is a very, very important issue. It has to be addressed, and it hasn't been addressed in public. It has to be addressed, yes.
What's up with Harvard being involved in matters of torture on the issue torture warrants? That was Dershowitz.
Dershowitz, yes, exactly.
An institute for interrogation technique.
And there's also the psychologist, I forget his first name, Fine, his last name, and he was at the Department of Defense and with a number of people from the White House explaining to them apparently for several hours, this was in the New York Times and a few weeks ago, how the science of intelligence has to be developed and there should be a special center for doing that and research has to be carried out systematically. So, and Harvard also was involved, by the way, Harvard, Cornell. They were involved very, very deeply in the research on sensory deprivation that took place, you know, between 1952 and 1962, which is very well documented by Al McCoy. Yeah, this chapter, I mean, the medical profession and also the intellectuals, I mean, the academics. The Army has recruited professional anthropologists in Afghanistan to help them do what they call human mapping, which is because they speak the language. These are people who, you know, had already done work in Afghanistan. They speak the dialect, and they go into in the tribes and talk to the people and give that information. They move with military units. And I'm hearing my profession. I'm hearing that sociologists might be also involved in that kind of work. I do know that unlike the American Historical Association, for example, the American Sociological Association does not have a group of people that is anti-war or anti-torture. And I find this, actually, this is a personal experience I have had. I wanted to give a talk at the forthcoming American Sociological Association's meeting, which will take place in Boston in August. And I wanted to talk about the similarities and differences between the French in Algeria and the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I was told that the paper did not fit in the session. And this is quite egregious. So I contacted the executive officer and I said, is this, you know, part of censorship?
Can you comment on the relationship that may exist between torture that would be practiced in a prison or by the police in a society that is democratic or not at war and the torture that you described, which is more something that happens in colonization and in war?
Well, torture, it's a good question. I mean, torture is torture, and no matter who is really engaging in it, it's cruel and unusual pain and suffering. So the difference is really when it is systematic. So I'm addressing the systematic aspect of it as part of a war, and here either a war of occupation or a war of decolonization. But we have torture on occasion in American prisons. This is a well-known fact. There are tortures, you know, carried out on behalf of the United States under the rubric of rendition in places like Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Syria, and Thailand, you know, which is very interesting. And so torture is torture in terms of it being having to be prohibited. It should be prohibited no matter who does it, the police or the third world state or the army. And the army in Abu Ghraib, in Afghanistan or in Iraq, the army is not just doing it on its own. We have had more and more information showing that up and down the line, you know, at the Department of Defense, the State Department, the White House, people knew and torture was done, you know, in the name of the United States and condoned by the state. And so it's a matter of the questions that torture raises when it is done systematically for the purpose of remaining in a country or completely redesigning its political structure or even its political map. But in essence, it's still torture. Yes.
Just to add something to Harvard University history, and it's ingrained into the system. In the 19th century, they had the biggest library, archives of black skull with America's most important scientist, Sam Morton, who they were collecting black skulls as study them, fraud data perhaps, as the black people have bigger skull than white, therefore they're more beast-like, therefore it's okay to enslave them. That's Harvard. Has a history too. Most of the American Ivy League universities, and now that takes me to my point, which is the question to you, is that looking at the indigenous people in this country, this has been going on for years. Nazis and everybody learned from here. Yeah. I mean, we're in stolen land as we're speaking right now, so there's no one should have any moral illusion, if anything. Where did that come from, that moral illusion of it? I mean, here you have people stealing lands, kidnapping hundreds of millions from Africa, committing the most heinous crimes, religionized it, philosophized it, rationalized it, legalized it, and they live as like they came from the moon somewhere.